today. It's taken months of work and millions of pounds. But why is England's contact tracing system still failing to reach enough people? This week, the Health Secretary Matt Hancock announced that Public Health England is being scrapped.
We'll have a new National Institute for Health Protection whose sole mission is to respond to the pandemic and to spot future risks and future pandemics and bring all that together under one roof.
The decision to replace the agency, which has played a key role in the country's response to coronavirus, has been criticised by people from across the health sector who say this is happening at the worst possible time. Some are also concerned about the track record of the woman tasked with heading the new National Institute for Health Protection.
Thank you, Secretary of State.
Baroness Dido Harding.
So I'd like to offer my heartfelt thanks to Public Health England, all our NHS colleagues, local authorities and their directors of public health and their teams, and to everyone who has signed up to be a contact tracer.
She's been in charge of England's coronavirus test and trace system, which was hailed as world-beating, but has been beset by problems.
We will be constantly developing and improving as we go.
The World Health Organization describes contact tracing as critical to controlling the spread of the virus. But months after the national system launched, contact tracers are still struggling to reach as many people as they need to. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, the trouble with England's test and trace system. Josh Halliday, you're The Guardian's North of England correspondent, and you've been reporting on England's test and trace system for the past few months. What is it and how should it work?
Well, if you test positive for coronavirus, you'll get a call from one of the government's contact tracers, and you'll be asked a series of questions about who you've been in close contact with, which means in close proximity within 2 metres for 15 minutes or longer, and where you've been as well. So which pubs, parks, gyms you've been to. And it's your duty, you've been told, to provide them with as much information as you can. And that includes handing over the contact details of close family and friends that you've been in touch with.
And with that information that you give them if they call you, what do they do with that?
They use that to make a database of all of your contacts and where you've been. And they assign all of those contacts to one of these teams of contact tracers who then tries to contact all your friends and family. And what this does really is try to build up a picture of where the infection is in that community. So from your address that you give, perhaps, they might be able to find a cluster of cases in your household, or if you've been to a pub at the weekend, they might be able to find 5 or 6 people who were also in that pub at the same time and who were also infected. And then this data eventually trickles down to local health authorities who then take measures on the ground.
Is this test and trace system one that's been used in England before to control other viruses?
So this test and trace system is quite familiar to what we've used in the past to control diseases such as tuberculosis or sexually transmitted infections, which have always been controlled by local authorities and their directors of public health, who have these small teams of contact tracers who are absolute experts at prying really difficult and tricky information out of people. And it should have been an ideal setup to launch what would have been a national test and trace effort to clamp down on this disease.
So England essentially already had test and trace systems in place, with thousands of people around the country doing this work before the pandemic began. But in a previous episode of Today in Focus, we saw how when the infection rate was increasing in March, the government decided to stop contact tracing as there was an overwhelming number of coronavirus cases. What did they decide to do next?
Well, at the end of April, they decided that they were going to set up this massive test and trace system, and it'd be underpinned by an app that it wanted most people who had smartphones in the UK to download for it to be effective. And To supplement this, there'd be what Matt Hancock described as an army of contact tracers, so 25,000 people.
Mr. Speaker, they have stepped up to serve their country in its hour of need, and I want to thank them in advance for the life-saving work that they're about to do.
Who they said would track 10,000 new cases a day and be in place by the 1st of June. And Boris Johnson famously said it would be a world-beating system.
We will have a test, track and trace operation that will be world-beating. And yes, it will be in place. It will be in place by June the 1st.
And separately, they launched a contact tracing app, which they trialled on the Isle of Wight.
And of course, we're developing the contact tracing app, which can help us deliver test, track and trace on the mass scale that we need across the country.
Something I remember the Health Secretary, Matt Hancock, being very excited about.
I'm grateful to the huge enthusiasm shown by Islanders who know that by participating in this pilot, they're at the forefront of helping get Britain back on her feet. Where the Isle of Wight goes, Britain follows.
What happened to that?
The vast majority of people on the Isle of Wight played ball with the app, and most eligible people had it on their smartphones. But the app essentially disappeared because it was useless at detecting 96% of contacts for people with Apple iPhones, which is a big chunk of us, actually. And there's another model, which is Google Android model, and that also had serious flaws. Essentially, it couldn't figure out a lot of the time what distance you were from someone else. The app basically failed in its key function.
The app is a small part of England's contact tracing system. The bulk of it is a national programme split between Public Health England, NHS employees and two private companies, Serco and Sitel. The more high profile of these is Serco. What exactly are they responsible for?
Through Serco, nearly 20,000 people were employed to be essentially call handlers who would ring people who have coronavirus and find out all their details and then make contact with their friends and family.
I'm joined by the Chief Executive, Rupert Soames. Good morning.
Good morning, Katie.
Since May, they've only reached half of all the 90,000 people who've been in close contact with an infected person. So that's 40,000 people who've been missed in 9 weeks.
Yeah. As to the tracing contracts, I think we need to get this into a proportion. You're saying, quoting at me, the numbers saying that we're tracing 50% of contacts. Let me tell you, is that 96% of the people that we talk to agree to self-isolate. So we've got a very, very high success rate of people that we get to contact.
When you reach them, though.
That really does not sound like a world-beating system. And the government haven't sufficiently answered why they're not getting on top of this, especially when these missed contacts, many of these missed contacts live in the same household as an infected person.
So they're struggling to contact people who are even in the same house as someone who has coronavirus.
I mean, the government say that what they're hearing is that an infected person tells the contact tracer that they don't want the contact tracing team to contact their family members because they would rather tell them themselves that they've got the coronavirus and tell them informally to self-isolate. Test and trace then don't follow up on that.
And is there any incentive to self-isolate from the point of view of what could happen if you don't? I mean, can people be punished if they don't stay at home?
There's absolutely no one checking if you're self-isolating once you've been contacted by Test and Trace. And that's, again, one of the biggest flaws. You'll get two texts from the government, you'll get an email, and then you'll get 10 telephone calls. But if you don't reply to any of them, then you're considered no longer on the system. Whereas in Germany, for example, they've got this huge number of scouts who go around knocking on people's doors who've said that they'll self-isolate.
If somebody rang you now and I said, tell me everybody that you have met, been in contact with in the last 48 hours and tell me on the telephone, give me their contact details, how many do you think that you'd be able to reel off the top of your head?
So that's why it's proving so hard.
I think people will be looking at that and they're asking, really, is it really value for money, given given the success rate and given what we've been hearing from many of these contact tracers over the past 9 weeks about them basically sitting idle, sitting twiddling their thumbs for weeks on end.
And I've had several contact tracers employed by Serco giving interviews talking about how little they've been doing.
So you've worked 38 hours as a clinical contact tracer on shift since this system went live and you haven't phoned anyone?
No, I've had no contact from anyone. I've had no contact from supervisors. I've literally been on the system, refreshed the system and entertained myself during that watching Netflix.
So taxpayers are paying you to watch Netflix?
Yeah, and it's frustrating.
One person I spoke to last week said it had been his quietest week in the job, yet he'd been offered overtime. It just doesn't make sense.
How can there be a lack of work when there are so many cases of coronavirus in the country?
They're trying to figure out better ways of doing this because they realise that not everyone will answer a phone call from an obscure 0300 number. So they're about to start sending people out door to door. But for the last 9 weeks, that's not something that they've been doing.
Okay, so England had a very specialised local test and trace network, but the government chose to instate a new national system that seems to be struggling and an app that failed. When there was a coronavirus outbreak a couple of months ago in Leicester...
While cases in most parts of the country have fallen since the peak, in Leicester, they've continued to rise.
How did the national system support local public health officials there to deal with it?
In Leicester, the council complained that the government wasn't communicating with them hardly at all before they were forced into the UK's first lockdown on June 30th. And the mayor, Peter Soulsby, said that their lockdown could have been avoided if they'd have had more information and more data sharing from central government.
We need to understand whether we have an outbreak in all or part of Leicester and where it is and which neighbourhoods or communities might be affected. And it's been incredibly frustrating because after weeks of asking, it was only just 3 days ago that we began to get the first of the data that will enable us to look at street level.
At that time, local authorities were getting very, very basic postcode level data from central government, which meant that they had to piece the rest together themselves. After they were forced into lockdown, the council in Leicester started to get more support from the government. But it took a lot of blood, sweat and tears and a lot of angry words and recriminations in public between central government and the mayor of Leicester.
Had incredible frustration in getting figures out of them. They dumped a first load on us last Thursday after weeks of asking. And as I say, 4 minutes past one this morning, I finally find out what they really are considering for Leicester. And when looking at the report, I realise that there's very little substance in it.
And now they've set up their own local test and trace system. They're reporting an 89% success rate in contacting people, because essentially they know more easily where these people are. Language barriers are overcome. You've got trust issues with central government, which are overcome. And you've got local experienced health workers with knowledge of the community who are better able to win their trust, which is absolutely essential when you're trying to trace every single person that they've been in contact with over the recent weeks.
Complaints about the lack of local data in Leicester have been echoed by public health officials I've been speaking to for this episode, including one who works in a town which is part of the further restrictions that are currently in place in Greater Manchester, despite having the lowest number of new infections in the area.
Okay, I'm Professor Kate Ardern. I'm the Director of Public Health for Wigan Council, and I've been co-leading the work on setting up contact tracing in Greater Manchester.
I mean, a very big job at the moment, particularly on the day that I'm speaking to you. We've just found out that the area that you're in is going to continue to be under a stricter lockdown than other parts of the country.
Well, enhanced public health measures, I think perhaps is a better term to use.
What is your assessment of the national system so far?
I think the national system could be working much more effectively with us. And what I would like to see is a sort of reverse takeover whereby the local system actually takes over the national assets. What sometimes people think contact tracing is about is simply giving someone a phone call and giving them advice and expecting them to follow it. Whereas those of us who've got a lot of experience in contact tracing know that the phone call is just the start. You've actually got to help that individual manage the consequences of the advice you're giving. If you want people to actually comply with the advice, that has been missed in the national thinking, not recognising that, for example, if people work in the gig economy or they're self-employed, it's much more difficult to be off work for 14 days.
Do you think lockdowns in areas like yours could have been avoided if a more localised test and trace system had been established earlier?
Yes, if we'd had it earlier, we would have been able, I think, to follow what's been the experience in South Korea, for example. They've been able to manage through very targeted interventions and keep both society and the economy going. And I think that's a really important lesson, because COVID is going to be with us for quite some time to come. I know people get very excited about vaccines and antivirals, but the fact of the matter is there is not going to be a mass vaccination program anytime soon. And we have to live with this virus. So actually having a track and trace and local surveillance approach helps us to live with this in a way that is less disruptive to society and the economy.
So I wonder why you think that the government took a national, more centralised approach when they first got going with contact tracing.
Lots of people who work in central government, and this is both, if you like, in the civil service, policy advisers and ministers, have actually very little experience of the local system. Very few of them have worked in it. If you don't know what we do and you don't know what we're capable of, then you go for what you're familiar with. And if the familiar thing is to contract out and commission, you know, a sort of private sector provider to do things, that's what you will naturally reach for. You can't commission relationships.
Josh, we've just heard from Kate about the problems she's had in Wigan with the national system, but they are now making changes to it, aren't they?
The model that they've drifted towards now is focused on the local response. So local directors of health have finally been given a lot of the data and most of the resources, but not all, that they need to fight the outbreak.
Coming up, the government faces questions about why private companies were awarded contracts to run part of England's contact tracing system. Josh, we've been talking about the national contact tracing system in England. The devolved nations, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, are doing things slightly differently. And you've been looking at the Welsh example, haven't you?
Well, Wales have got their own system of test and trace called Test, Trace and Protect. But essentially, it's locally led.
Hello, Josh. How are you?
I'm all right, Kelechi. Yeah, how are you doing? You okay?
One of the things that Kelechi Noam, who is a public health boss in Wales, says is incredibly important is that in the Welsh system, they do actually offer financial support in some circumstances for people who have to self-isolate. When there was an outbreak in a meat factory, for example, in Merthyr Tydfil, some of the workers wouldn't been able to self-isolate because they couldn't afford to. And so some financial support was offered by the Test, Trace and Protect system.
Now, because this particular meat factory had so many workers from different countries, different languages, people living in houses, multiple occupation, a lot of these people are on low wages. If they have to isolate, it'll have a significant economic impact on them. And we needed to account for all of that. So translations, we did multiple translations. We got through to private landlords.
The only national involvement is to provide funding and the framework for how it will operate and the data sharing. Although they don't release as many figures as the English system does, they seem to be doing very well, reaching as many as 90% of people who test positive and 90% of their contacts.
Right, so they're doing well with a local system that also in one case made sure workers had financial help when they had to self-isolate. How does that work in the English system?
People who have to self-isolate, they're not given any financial support to do so. So there's lots of people who can't afford to self-isolate because they would have to go on statutory sick pay, for example, which is about £96 a week. And Dido Harding acknowledges that this is a problem, but this is still something that's not been ironed out and sorted by government. And that is one of the next key battlegrounds, I think.
The government has defended its test and trace system, but last week they announced they would be making changes to it. What are they going to be doing differently now?
So from a couple of weeks ago, the government decided that they'll assign a ring-fenced team of contact tracers to any local authority in England that wants them. These teams of contact tracers will be healthcare professionals. But what they've also said they'll do is cut this massive team of Serco contact tracers down by 6,000 people, which is basically an admission that they overhired and they didn't have enough work to do. And the rest will be redistributed to the local efforts. What they've also done, and which I think is more important if you speak to any local director of health, is give any council that wants it access to a near real-time database of who's testing positive in their area.
So changes are being made, but questions have been raised about why this contract was outsourced to Cytel and Serco in the first place. Something Health Minister Nadine Dorries defended in Parliament in July, saying that the public sector couldn't have provided enough staff in a short space of time. But since then, The Guardian has seen evidence that Serco may have received preferential treatment from the government in being allocated this contract.
It's really curious because they got a phone call in January about this potential to set up a massive test and trace effort and could they do it. This is the same time that, you know, the government were playing down the severity of the pandemic publicly and saying it wouldn't be as big an issue here as it was, for example, in China. And it's 4 months before the test and trace system was actually set up. So what I think it kind of shows is this instinct towards a centralised, outsourced system for tackling some of the biggest problems in our society. In the government's defence, what has changed in those months is that the pandemic in England has moved from a national issue. All parts of the country were affected, whereas now it's a series of local flare-ups and outbreaks.
It's clear, Josh, that the government sort of have made a wobbly start then to the test and trace system. And on the one hand, that's understandable to the extent that this crisis is on a level that the country's never had to deal with before. But as we look ahead to the winter and conversations about a potential second wave, would you say we're at the point where the test and trace system is still not working as well as it should be?
I think there's a lack of detail in the system. We don't know how many of the contacts that have been reached by test and trace actually self-isolate because we don't do any checking. We don't know how many develop symptoms. We don't know how many go on to get tested. And that, I think, shows a massive oversight in the system. We've been obsessed with the headline figures of tracing these people and ticking off boxes to say that they've been contacted. I just don't think that's good enough. And it puts us in a really difficult situation for the coming weeks and months when we're going to be reopening schools and universities are going back. And we're reliant on a test and trace system that's missing half of all the people that it tries to contact.
And what has become of the contact tracing app? Is there a new app now?
They're currently trying a new system in the Isle of Wight and in Newham in London. And they still haven't ironed out the technological problems that the initial app had. But this one is basically built more to be a personal risk assessment. So based on characteristics like your age, where you live, your previous health conditions, and your geography, so whereabouts you are in the country, it'll give you a sort of warning about how likely you are to be affected. One thing that is different on this new app is that you'll be able to check in with a QR code when you go to a pub, for example, or a restaurant, so they can basically get an idea of where you've been and where any hotspots might be if it turns out that you or whoever else is there has coronavirus.
I know QR codes are common, but I still think of them as quite an old-fashioned thing.
Yeah, it's funny how it's taken coronavirus for them to start being used a bit more widespread. I'd never used one before, but before ordering a pint the other day.
Josh, the government's handling of test and trace seems to be part of a pattern that has emerged during this pandemic, where they forge ahead with decisions against best advice, spend enormous amounts of money, and then have to make a U-turn when they realise it was the wrong course of action. We've seen this with testing, with the building of new hospitals, and also to some extent with the way they've handled the exam situation over the past couple of weeks. What do you think this tells us?
I think it tells us that this is a government that is desperate to be in control of absolutely every single element of the fight back against the pandemic. And sometimes the experts exist outside the government bubble.
Josh, thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
That was Josh Halliday. Do read his coverage of England's test and trace system at theguardian.com. Where you can also find this week's episode of Science Weekly, which is all about the ethics of contact tracing apps and what using them will mean for us. We asked the Department of Health and Social Care for a response to this episode, and they told us that NHS Test and Trace is reaching 79% of people who test positive and 83.4% of their contacts where contact details were provided. They said they'll continue to scale up or scale down the number of staff working in contact tracing over the coming months according to how the virus spreads. Local authorities, they added, have been given £300 million to develop local outbreak control plans, and they now have access to daily data on who has tested positive, including their address, sex and age, NHS number, job title, and the date of their test. We also asked Serco for a response, and a spokesperson told us, Serco has played an important part in helping to reach hundreds of thousands of people who might otherwise have passed on the virus. Our team of Tier 3 call handlers has been 93% successful in persuading people to isolate where we are able to have conversations. Thanks to Josh, Kate Ardern and Kalechi Noham for speaking to us for today's episode. It was produced by Hannah Moore and sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.